Today, we're very pleased to have Gerard ter Hooft. He got his PhD in Utrecht, did a postdoc at CERN, and then was hired back to Utrecht, where he's a professor. He's won a whole slew of awards, from minor things like the Nobel Prize to more important honors like being named Perimeter Institute Distinguished Visiting Research Chair. And today he's going to tell us about the cellular automaton interpretation of quantum mechanics.
It is a great joy for me to be back at this institute, marvelous new site which is devoted to exactly the kind of physics that I like most. So when I was asked to talk here, it was not difficult to find a subject for my talk. I've been working on this for quite a while, and I'm busy writing down what I found out about this. The topic is a little bit of a heresy, as you will see. So the motivation for the work that I was doing was that I wanted to understand more about quantum and gravity, about the black hole information problem, and indeed also I wanted to see if I can answer questions concerning the standard model of the subatomic particles. So I started to think about such subjects. I end up finding answers to other questions. And the other questions is the things that are keeping people quite busy these days, such as the measurement problem, the collapse of the wave function, Schrödinger's cat, and also Born probability. All these issues have been, during the conference here, they have been very much at the center of people's minds. And I think that the way I'm now thinking about these topics, these questions find very natural answers. And I'll try to explain to you what these answers are. There's also a surprise answer as I see it. I have a somewhat, I think, revolutionary answer to the problem of time, the arrow of time. Why is there so much difference between time running forward and time running backwards? And we've seen many talks about the subject. Many books have been written about it. But now it seems that the topic that I'll be discussing here may shed, again, a new light on such questions. So first of all, I'm a very sober physicist. I don't like mysticism. Whenever people talk about quantum mechanics, it's with reverence and with some sort of devotion and also with awe for the strange laws of quantum mechanics. I don't like that situation at all. I like very much mathematical physics, and I think mathematical physics should be based on logic and only on logic and not on mysticism or beliefs or whatever. So I want to leave that out. But actually also, when it comes to that, when describing laws of nature, it is not nice to see laws where probabilities play a central role. And here, as most of you know already, Albert Einstein was complaining about this aspect of quantum mechanics, that why should there be probability in the laws of physics? Of course, if you try to find solutions of the laws of physics and you don't understand everything, your predictions will contain probability, and that's inevitable. We understand that. That's not my problem, Einstein said, but the problem is that probability seems to play an essential role in even formulating the laws of nature, and that shouldn't be the case. I'm carrying this, in fact, even a few steps further. No Hilbert space is going, not in the laws of nature, Hilbert space is going to be used in trying to solve the equations. Then you may use every machine that you can get in your math toolbox. And also the whole notion of qubits sounds a bit mysterious, already a little bit too mysterious to me. I want to keep things simple and not introduce qubits, not complex numbers. In fact, my claim is, and we had this in discussion day before yesterday, the question is, what is the meaning of real numbers in physics? Can you imagine theoretical physics without the use of real numbers? No, but I claim not yet. I think the ultimate laws of nature shouldn't contain such man-made products as real numbers. But I'll explain that more in a moment. Let's do one thing at a time first. So, when you really think of the bottom line of some very basic theories of nature, what would be more natural than thinking that the laws of nature are just like a clockwork? There are gears moving around, and they all move according to precisely defined laws of dynamics, leaving nothing to chance at all. So this is the kind of theory I would like to see. Now, liking something maybe not be the right way of thinking about physics. You don't want to get what you like to get, but you want to get actually information about the truth. But this is, for a moment, the setting of my mind that nature should be extremely logical. And this was, of course, very much like the way people thought in the 19th century. Maxwell was known for already thinking of that his laws of the electromagnetic fields are like little gears in space and time, which are just moving the way they should, and they are controlled by completely fixed deterministic laws of nature. And Laplace also said that if only we knew the laws of nature with infinite precision, if you know every atom right now, then we should be able to compute exactly what happens into the indefinite future. Well, as you all know, things didn't quite happen that way. We got quantum mechanics instead, which is saying very, very different things. The problem with that is that if you want to apply quantum mechanics to all of nature, in particular the entire universe, and also in particular the gravitational force, then you hit all sorts of difficulties. And these difficulties have been studied at length, and they only become more difficult the more you think about them. So one way to get a different picture of nature could be see if quantum mechanics can be replaced by a clockwork. Now, before you all say we've proven that's impossible, let me start to address the problem from the other end and see what it brings us. So I'd like to now think for a moment about nature as being described by models. So the simplest model of anything happening in the universe is when there's periodic motion. So think of a planet going around the sun, but think of just atoms which are rotating. All that is periodic motion. So let's take periodic motion as the most basic building blocks of a model of nature. And to emphasize that it's all like cogwheels going in a completely fixed, determined way, I call this the cogwheel model. This is a cogwheel with three teeth, and the model could hardly not have been any simpler than this. The model says that I have a universe which in this simplified description only contains three states, labeled 1, 2, and 3, and the laws of nature can be written down on one piece of paper. State number 1 will evolve to state number 2, state number 2 will go to state number 3, state number 3 will go to state number 1, and you press the button, and this is my model of nature. You can hardly imagine anything easier than that. But actually, you can describe this thing as if it were quantum mechanics, because you can write down this law of nature as saying that we have the so-called permutation operator. In math, we know that replacing 1 by 2, a 2 by 3, and a 3 by 1 is what we call a permutation. The permutation operators have been well studied in mathematics, and what mathematicians often realize that is a profitable thing to do is to write a representation of the permutation operator. And they like to write it as a 3 by 3 matrix, which is just a 3 by 3 matrix on the top left here. So it's a very simple matrix containing just ones and zeros. And this is the way a mathematician likes to talk about the permutation operator. But actually, this is already the beginning of making the whole theory smell a little bit more like quantum mechanics. Why? Well, you work in a vector space, and states in nature are represented by a vector. And the permutation operator just replaces a vector by a vector which is orthogonal to the previous one, and then after 3 steps, you're back at where you were before. Now, again, from a mathematical point of view, you want to use the toolkits of mathematics. And one of the toolkits is that you can manipulate matrices. So you can think of the trace of a matrix, but you can exponentiate a matrix, you can add or subtract matrices. You can do a lot with matrices that you can't do with the permutation operator itself. So let's replace the permutator with a matrix. And then one thing that mathematicians like to do is diagonalize a matrix and then write it as an exponent. And this is all very easy. So we can write that matrix U, the evolution operator, as e to the minus I h, where h is basically the Hamiltonian. You could put a number delta t in there to say that there's a time step. And if the time step wasn't normalized to 1, I call it delta t, but that is just a simple number in there. Then we can ask which h will do the job. That's a very easy, if you know some mathematics, it's very easy to find the matrix which does the job. It's written down on below here, where kappa is just this complex number. Here you see complex numbers coming in from nowhere. Well, that's the thing. If you want to exponentiate a matrix, you already generate I very quickly. So complex numbers come out of your toolkit after a few seconds of mathematics. So this is a complex number, and that complex number, you put it in a matrix. This is the matrix which has the property that if I exponentiate it, it gives me this matrix. And in fact, this matrix has eigenvalues which are equally spaced. Again, that's very easy to understand if you know some mathematics, that because if you apply this matrix 3 times, I get the identity, it means that the eigenvalues of this h must be one of the 3 roots of 1, so 1 or e to the power plus or minus 2 pi over 3i, and that means that h itself has 3 possible values, which look like energy levels, which are equally spaced. So what we get here is that this Hamiltonian H can be used in a Schrödinger equation to say, okay, the Schrödinger equation is totally meaningless if your time is not a multiple of delta t. But if time is chosen to be a multiple of delta t, the Schrödinger equation with this Hamiltonian exactly reproduces this only too simple model. For this very simple model, perhaps this slide here is so simple that you don't see the beauty of it. But when you go to a little bit more complicated model, you suddenly see that this machinery becomes very, very powerful. So we can think of a slightly more complicated model where you have, this actually shows 31 yellow dots. And the yellow dots arrange in a pattern that shows how the laws of nature could now be chosen. This is just an example. So at the left, you see 6 dots which connect to each other. So after 6 steps, if you sit on the left there, you will go to yourself. But you see other circuits containing 8 or 3 or 2 dots. And the law is very simple. You just follow those lines in the direction of the arrows. And that is the law of nature, just a slightly little bit more complicated than the previous one. But I can do exactly the same thing. How? Well, it's very easy. If you sit in any of these particular circuits, you can forget all the others. You will sit on those spots. And some of these circuits contain, say, 6 positions. So the Hamiltonian will have 6 equally distant lines. That's this spectrum on the left. I can take a 7th one here, but the 7th one coincides with the 0. So these are states 0, 1, and minus 1 in the energy representation. So the energy is now equal space. These other things, so this is the 6 here, but this is a sequence of 8 spots. So they're a little bit narrower. The stretch of the Hamiltonian is the same, because once I end up at the top here, the Hamiltonian will be a multiple of 2 pi, and that means if I exponentiate that, I get back to the original position. So these energy levels are superfluous after I've gone over this line, I can stop. But so here is a place where you have just 3 lines. So there's those 3, and these are a larger number here. I forgot how many these are, 11 or so. And this is just a flip-flop. You would also have that. It flip-flops back to itself. There's only 2 energy lines. What you can now do is, when you write this Hamiltonian, you can freely add a constant to the energy at every of these sequences can be shifted up or down. The point is that just gives you a phase factor, which will be physically unobservable. So that's just adding a constant to the energy constants which will be absolutely conserved. So that change in Hamiltonian will have no physical effect whatsoever. And I allow myself to make such changes. So then this is going to be the spectrum of states. If I now squeeze them all together to get the entire energy spectrum of the system, I get a fairly complicated looking spectrum like this. So now I say, well, let's turn the whole argument upside down. Suppose I had a quantum system where this were the energy spectrum, and you see the energy spectrum can be fairly general. Right? This is a fairly generic looking energy spectrum when you see, look at this plot here. So suppose I have a model like this, I can say, well, now let's disentangle this spectrum in this way and go back, and I see that that model actually has an interpretation of this system. Now, what is special about this model? It's here it looks quantum mechanical. This looks like an interesting quantum Hamiltonian. But here it looks totally classical. It just tells you that once you have these states, you just evolve and the system is completely deterministic. So at this level, you have a deterministic model. But when you look here, it looks very much like a quantum model. My claim is now this is a quantum model. If I write it this way, I've used my math tool to turn this classical theory into a quantum theory. And quantum mechanics, well, the mathematics of quantum mechanics is such an important mathematical tool that now I start to believe that maybe the reason why our world is quantum mechanical as we perceive it is that it is the only way to compute how things evolve when the universe, it would be much, much more complicated than this. Of course, imagine our universe doesn't have 31 states. It has innumerably many states, more like 10 to the 10 to the 31 or something states. So the real universe is so much more complicated that if you do this to the real universe, it would be very, very difficult to see by just looking at the energy spectrum that the universe is or is not of such a shape. So now the cellular automaton interpretation, I'll explain in a minute what a cellular automaton is, the interpretation suggests that that actually there is a way to reconsider our universe as if it were a deterministic system with no quantum mechanics at all, no probabilities at all, but I can use this tool to turn to something that looks like the real quantum theory that we're looking at. Perhaps, indeed, the thing called the standard model of the subatomic particles is of this form, or perhaps only if you add the gravitational force, which will be quite a complicated thing to consider. But eventually, this is what we try to do. We won't understand how gravity works, how a fundamental particle works, and all that. So maybe it helps if you think, let's try to search for models of this type. Now, I had the word cellular automaton in the title, so I have to explain what that is. A cellular automaton, here it's pictured as if it was a one-dimensional array of cells horizontally. Vertically is the time evolution. So a cellular automaton is an array of cells, but you can think of a three-dimensional array, then it looks more like our universe. Our universe could be completely filled with cells, which has data of every spot in the universe. Forget for a moment that the universe is curved and everything like that. That's for the future. Let's, for a moment, consider a simple situation that you have just a flat universe, and there is data, there's information at every spot in space, and indeed every spot in space and time. And there's a law of nature that tells you how these data in space and time evolve as time goes on. A cellular automaton claims that there's a very simple evolution law where what happens at every spot in the universe only depends on what sits in its neighbors. And the universe does not look directly at what happens very far away. Now, this is the concept of locality, and locality is getting lots of attention in the meeting that we're in now, whether the universe really is local or not. And you're welcome to suspect that maybe your locality is not the end of the world. Maybe there are non-local forces. Maybe the universe doesn't really have classical information, but also quantum information in it. You're quite welcome to believe all that, but let's start with something very simple. So I start with describing the universe as if it were extremely simple, and then you can make some very interesting remarks about cellular automata. It is now important to suspect that the cellular automaton will be time reversible. Why do I need time reversibility? Well, in that case, the evolution law is a permutator, and the matrix corresponding to that permutator will be a unitary matrix. A unitary matrix can be written as e to the minus I times a Hermitian Hamiltonian. Hermeticity in Hamiltonian is very important in quantum mechanics. It makes quantum mechanics work in the first place. It makes that probabilities are exactly conserved, and we wouldn't understand how nature works if probabilities were not exactly conserved. So that is why I think that the accelerator automaton is time reversible. But I'll return to this question later in my lecture. But let's start out thinking that we have a time reversible accelerator automaton, and the accelerator automaton evolves in two steps. The evolution law is split up in two steps. One evolution law evolves the yellow dots, and the other then moves the red spots accordingly. So a Cauchy surface is, for instance, this grayish sector contains all the data. If you know the data in the gray region, so there are yellow and red spots in the gray region, then you can go forward in time, it goes up, or you can go backwards in time, going down. And the rule that I wrote down is now called the Margolis rule, that says that there are steps of kind of type A, which reproduce the new cell A1, if you know the cell A0 in here. So at this A, evolution law tells you A1 if I know A0, and if I know its neighbors, B0 here. The neighbors are not going to be affected by evolution law A, only the yellow, so the A1 is... It replaces A0 by something else, depending on what its neighbors are. And that law should be reversible. So if you know A1, you can calculate A0. If you know A0, you can calculate A1. And similarly, there's a law of type B that does the same thing to the red cells. Here, B2 depends on B1, and the law depends on the neighbors A1 and A2. The nice thing about such a law is that you can write it as e to the minus ia times e to the minus ib, where a is the sum of contributions at every spot in space, and b is the sum of contributions at every spot in space as well, where these a's of x all commute with each other. They commute with each other just because the evolution can be written in arbitrary order. If you only look at the yellow cells, you can do it in arbitrary order when you look at the red cells. But the only thing you cannot do is update an A type cell and a B type cell when they're both neighbors. Then the result depends on the order. So A of X and B of X prime do not commute only if A, X, and X prime are neighbors. Everything else commutes, and that makes the evolution law easy to access mathematically. Then, namely, you can use the so-called Campbell-Baker-Hausdorff series. The Campbell-Baker-Hausdorff series tells you that you can write this thing as the exponent of an operator H, or a matrix H, where H in first approximation looks like A plus B, but not quite, because A and B do not commute. So you get a correction, which is the commutator of the A and B. But that commutator is only non-vanishing if A and B are neighbors. So only the neighboring parts contribute in this commutator. But then the series goes on with commutators of commutators and so on. The nice thing about this expression is that every single entry in this series behaves like a local Hamiltonian. So the entire Hamiltonian looks like observing locality. And so what you get out of this is something that looks like a quantum field theory, where the quantum field theory is described by a Hamiltonian, which obeys locality properties very much like the real thing in, say, the standard model of the subatomic particles. Indeed, this Hamiltonian looks very much like the Hamiltonian of the subatomic particles. Not quite. There are subtle difficulties. One difficulty is, where is Lorentz invariance? Well, there isn't. There is a maximum speed. Information cannot go faster than diagonally in this automaton. So there's a limiting speed of light. So much it has in common with the real world, but I don't have exact Lorentz transformations. So that will be a difficulty that will have to be addressed sooner or later. Where does Lorentz invariance come from? But let's do one thing at a time. There is, suppose that we could make a cutoff in this K Campbell Baker House of Series. Then Hamiltonian would be the sum of Hamiltonian densities, and that is very much like quantum field theory. Unfortunately, there's a little problem. The Campbell Baker House of Series does not converge. So there are states for which every term will be bigger than the previous one, and that's not a good series. If I were allowed to terminate the series, I would have a beautiful quantum model which would have a natural classical interpretation as a classical cellular automaton. Life is not that good for me, so this is not true. The series doesn't really converge. Well, later, if I have time, but time is running fast, if I have time, I explain some more technical example where I can replace this cellular automaton with something better. Again, a cellular automaton, but phrased slightly differently, such that I do get a Hamiltonian, which is properly bounded. But I actually want two things. I want locality, and I want positivity. The Hamiltonian should have a lowest eigenvalue. Why? Well, that is the vacuum state. That will be the empty state of quantum field theory. I need quantum mechanics, but I need the quantum mechanics to be able to describe the vacuum state as the lowest energy state, and I want locality and all that. Those demands turn out to be nearly completely conflicting in when you do the mathematics. You find locality and positivity don't go well together. You have to do hard work. But I claim this work can be done, but requiring much more work. In the meantime, let's for a moment leave that as a technical question to be answered later. Let's assume that you can do such a thing, that you can write down a model that is a completely deterministic model, but when I write Hamiltonian as a permutation operator, I can do that, and it looks like Hamiltonian of the standard model. Wouldn't that be great? Well, that would be a model where I would be able to write down observables, which I call beables. The word beable has already been used in the conference here, but I'll use it in my way. A beable is just an observable, an operator, which happens to commute at all times. So the beables are operators which are defined as time-dependent operators in the Heisenberg picture, and they may be given at different times and at different spots, and they all commute, because the entries of the cells in the cellular automaton are completely commutable as observables go. So I want to see if I can find such commuting objects in a standard model. This is not known, by the way. In a standard model, we don't know which operators are actually commuting all the time. But let's assume that they exist. That's the cellular automaton interpretation hinges on the suspicion, theoretical suspicion, that such operators exist. Then the universe would be equivalent to a cellular automaton. And all I would have to do is write down the quantum Hamiltonian. The corresponding Schrödinger equation would be the Schrödinger equation of the universe. In a given quantum theory, we don't know in general how to make such a basis, but often we can come close, because as I showed to you, the average generic deterministic model may have a very, very complex Hamiltonian structure, so you can probably mimic a lot of nature. So let's assume you can and see what this amounts to. It would be a hidden variable theory with all its defects, as people usually regard. There is a lot of suspicion against hidden variable theories, but I'll address those points. Let me first explain a little bit what we do when we normally use quantum mechanics. When we do quantum mechanics, we don't care about commutation. Quite to the contrary, we assume many operators are not commuting, and we have a Hilbert space, and we use states in Hilbert space to see how they evolve. Those states are called templates. A template is a model calculation. You use some model state, and you assume that that state describes our universe, or our universe can be expanded in such states, and then we want to know how such states evolve. Well, the templates will evolve using the Schrödinger equation, but so will the ontological states. So ontological states are the states an automaton can actually be in, as if there were no quantum mechanics. And the templates are just superpositions of a large number of ontological states. That's the idea. So they all obey the same Schrödinger equation. So when we write an ontological state. The ontological state is some very special superposition of template states, but also the converse, a template state, is the inverse superposition of ontological states. They all obey the same Schrödinger equation. So this would be sort of the ground rules of working with the cellular automaton interpretation of quantum mechanics. But you can say a little bit more. Let's decide what we mean when we consider a superposition of ontological states. That wasn't in the laws of nature originally. In the laws of nature, we only knew about the ontological states themselves. Ontological meaning referring to what's really going on in the universe. So when we use a template and when we say it's a superposition of ontological states, we could just define the squares, the absolute squares of these lambda n, to be the probability. Suppose that we attempt to describe an evolving star or planet or whatever, an experiment in our universe, but we don't know which of the ontological states we are actually describing. So what we do instead is we take a probabilistic distribution. That's just reflecting our ignorance. But we can reflect our ignorance in many ways, and one way would be to write down a single template state where the coefficient lambda n, every single coefficient, reflects our uncertainty about which state we're actually looking at. So the absolute squares are defined to be the probabilities. It's obvious that we should use the absolute squares because we want to make orthogonal transformations. We want our unitary transformations. We want to go from one basis of Hilbert space to another basis. How do you do that? Well, normally we always make those transformations to be unitary. As long as you stick to unitary transformations, the squares of these coefficients are by far the most useful ones to define probabilities in. You could make different choices, but then you only make your life a lot harder. So let's take the squares of that and continue. Then, now comes a very important first calculation in this procedure. So now I'm going to do something which is basically new, and that is I ask myself questions about classical states. Because we know when we do quantum mechanics, normally we consider atoms and molecules and elementary particles and such. And then we measure something and we end up describing a classical state, like the state a detector can be in, or a state of something which is so large that quantum mechanics is no longer relevant, like the motion of planets around the sun, or in fact people sitting in a room. All those are classical states. How are the classical states related to the cellular automaton states of the theory? Now I'm going to make a dramatically simple assumption, which is that the classical states are also classical in the automaton variables. That's very non-trivial, but I have very good reasons to believe that. Just imagine a planet moving around the sun. Take 1 cubic millimeter inside the planet, a little volume delta V of 1 cubic millimeter. And now ask the question, can we, by looking at the cellular automaton and the states it is in, can we distinguish that from the vacuum state? Well, the statement is perhaps yes, perhaps no, we don't really know about 1 cubic millimeter. But let's assume that the data of the automaton in 1 cubic millimeter of solid matter is a little bit different from the data of the automaton when you have vacuum there. I thought this was a reasonable thing to suspect. But this does the whole job. If it's in 1 cubic millimeter, the difference between that and the vacuum is only epsilon. The epsilon is a small number, but it's positive. Then if you take the entire planet, which contains billions and billions of volumes like that, then if it's epsilon for only one volume of a cubic millimeter, then for the entire planet, it's e to the power of minus epsilon times v over delta v. But v is the volume of the planet, and delta v is the 1 cubic millimeter. Now, how many cubic millimeters go into a planet? That's a gigantic number. So when you raise e to the minus epsilon to that gigantic power, you get zero. And so you get for certainty that you can distinguish the planet from the vacuum. So the coordinates of the planet must be totally classical in terms of the cellular automaton. So That, to many people, that sounded be wrong, because it's a very crazy situation that we're now looking at. The classical states are ontological states, and classical states, that would be the simple reason why classical states never superimpose. Because the real way in which the universe works, the universe is in a single ontological state. Superpositions never happen. And this is the picture that then emerges. In the original model, we had the cellular automaton, those are the states at the left. This is all the atoms and particles that you normally describe as quantum states. All these quantum states are superpositions of ontological states. And these blue lines tell you which quantum state is which superposition. Nearly all ontological states superimpose to make our templates. Our templates are very important, very complicated. And then when we look at the macroscopic states, such as a planet moving in orbit, a spaceship, but also indeed the hands of a detector device, they are again macroscopic states, and the macroscopic states, as you are familiar with, are also superpositions of all these templates. So a particle moving somewhere always is in a superposition of plane waves. So all these are superpositions. And now I'm making this very bold statement that these submicroscopic states of the cellular automaton all merge to give each of them different macroscopic states. So here, every macroscopic state might be a probabilistic distribution of various ontological states, because the ontological states refer to details which are much smaller than the details of where a planet actually is moving. So there are many lines here, but they are not overlapping. The macro states are therefore completely ontological again, and they contain totally different ontological states. So you see how strange this is, because it looks as if this intermediate region is somehow short-circuited and disappears altogether. And in this picture, quantum mechanics has totally disappeared. So when you talk about classical states, you also talk about the classical state of an automaton. There's no quantum mechanics at the right-hand side of this picture. And that's very important, but that does the whole job. And that solves a number of vexing problems in quantum mechanics. For instance, when you do a measurement, what do you do when you do an experiment? You consider first a template state. The template state is a superposition of ontological states. And I declare those lambda n to be such that the absolute squares are probabilities. So that if the total probability is 1, this template state has norm 1. So it couldn't be simpler than that. Then look at the final state of a measurement. They all evolve with the same Schrödinger equation. So the template states obey the Schrödinger equation, but the ontic states obey the same Schrödinger equation. So these lambda n's don't change as a function of time. They stay the same. So the final state contains the same lambda n, but then the ontological states that the final thing can be in. And now we have a classical measurement. We look at the particles coming out of the detector, and they trigger, coming out of the experiment, they trigger a detector, and the detector goes into a classical state. Those are the states L, which describe the classical states of the detector. And now I just said that the classical states are ontological, and every ontological state evolves into a single ontological state in the future. That means that the same lambda n's will emerge in the final equations, which relates the outcome of the experiment to the classical states that the detector can be in. But the nice thing about this is that these are the Born probabilities. So often people consider the fact that there's an axiom of quantum mechanics saying that the absolute squares of these coefficients represent the probabilities, that is introduced as a mysterious new axiom. But here it comes out automatically, inevitably. But it was crucial for this outcome that these lambdas are just the Born probabilities. It was crucial for that to assume that the classical state of a measurement or a device or a planet or a spaceship, that those classical states are represented uniquely by the ontological states at the submicroscopic level. This is a very important result of that. So this basically explains to me the Born axiom, if you will, of ordinary quantum mechanics. It really comes out as the only possibility. So the essential thing is that the universe is in ontological states, and now you have to understand the probability structure of the theory. Classically, how do probabilities enter into an experiment? Well, the answer is very simple. In a classic experiment, you don't exactly know the initial state. When you collide two particles that come from a big distance, you don't know classically how these particles will hit each other. If you have beams of particles and you describe them classically, you don't know where every particle will hit every other particle. So you average over all possible probabilities and you get a probabilistic distribution of the outcome of the experiment. In quantum mechanics, you say, I know the initial state exactly, it's plane waves. Yes, that were the templates of the plane waves, but the plane waves are actually superpositions of ontological states. And in quantum mechanics, we get the Born amplitudes in the final, as computed from the final state. But now I claim those probabilities are the same probabilities. So the probabilities come in our calculations because we never know exactly what the initial state is. How can we know? We don't. Because we had to measure the initial state first. But you can try to measure that. But then again, you don't know the initial state going before that. So you can never exactly control the initial state. And that is why any measurement always ends up giving you a probabilistic distribution. It is inevitable in any theory of nature. So the collapse of the wave function now also comes completely naturally. The only statement you have to make is you assume that the universe as such is in a single ontological state. The universe never knows about superpositions. Superpositions are man-made because we have to work with probabilities because we don't know any better. But the universe is in a single ontological state. And that single ontological state obeys a Schrödinger equation. But it tells you that whenever you're interested in a particle hitting a detection device, that state will look like a collapsed state. So the collapse of the wave function also comes out completely naturally in this picture of quantum mechanics. And the same thing can be said about the famous Schrödinger cat. Probably you all know the story that Schrödinger had the idea of putting a cat in a box, and the cat is dead or alive depending on what the outcome of the measurement will be. And the strange question that you end up with when considering this experiment theoretically is it looks as if at the end of the experiment the cat is in a superimposed state. It's half live, half dead. It's alpha times a live cat plus beta times a dead cat. And why is it that that's not the true outcome of the experiment at all? The true outcome of the experiment is that every now and then when you do the experiment, you get a live cat, and about half of the time, you get a dead cat. And that's the correct way to predict. So how is it that superimposed cats are replaced by probabilistic cats? The answer is again the same, that the superposition coefficients were man-made artifacts when we chose the initial state. In reality, the initial state doesn't know about superpositions. It is always an ontological state. The dead cat and a live cat are both ontological, and therefore there's a probability that we get a dead cat and a probability that we get a live cat, but never a superposition. So also Schrödinger's cat problem, I think, is getting quite a natural answer. There are lots of jokes about Schrödinger's cat on the internet. This is one of them, where Mr. Schrödinger sits in the veterinarian clinic about his cat. And the vet comes in, Mr. Schrödinger, about your cat. I have good news and bad news. And that could also only be if the cat is in a superposition. She wants to explain to the Schrödinger that the cat is in a superposition. Of course, we now know that is never the case. Either she has good news or she has bad news. And now the argument why all of this is wrong, and well, many people have been throwing this argument to me. I'm not sure how much time to discuss it in detail. The famous Bell Gedanken experiment. And the experiment has it very quickly that there's a photon, the time runs vertically here, there's a photon, there's an atom prepared here which emits two entangled photons. Alice and Bob measure the polarization of photon by using a setting of the polarization filter, either A or B. And when you analyze what may happen in this experiment, you get a straight contradiction, or so it is claimed, with a deterministic theory. The contradiction could be taken away in principle if you take two rather strange assumptions. The first rather strange assumption is that actually Alice and Bob don't have free will to choose the setting of the apparatus. Instead, the setting they choose is determined by what happens in their brains and what happens in their past. Most physicists say, no, this is carrying things too far. Alice and Bob, whatever they think, should have nothing to do with the whole experiment. And as soon as you say that, you run into a big difficulty that you get a straight contradiction with the idea that everything is deterministic that happens here. So instead of, you know, following the argument saying this argument is wrong, you can do a simple calculation. Before doing the calculation, I'll just quickly mention to you an argument which was again presented on the web. They said, how ridiculous can your theory be? Imagine that both Bob and Alice, before they decide how to make the setting of the experiment, they carry with them a mouse in a cage. And the theory that I am presenting is absurd for the following reason. Both Bob and Alice carry a mouse, and at t equals t1, an atom emits two entangled photons. Long after that, Bob and Alice inspect their mouse, and they count the number of mouse droppings. If it is even, they choose this setting. If the mouse dropping is odd, they choose that setting. And now we claim that the atom emitting two photons, long before the mouse droppings were counted, the atom knew about the mouse droppings because there's correlations. And the usual argument I get, how can this possibly be? How could it be that an atom knows in advance how many mouse droppings a mouse will make? That can't be right. Well, before saying it can't be right, let's do a simple calculation. And so I calculated what would be the necessary correlation function between the mouse droppings and the setting of these and the polarization of the photons. And this is the minimum amount of correlation that you need. It's a non-vanishing, non-trivial three-point correlation function. The variable here is C is the polarization of the photons. A and B are the settings chosen by Bob and Alice. And that variable is x, as a function of x, the probability that the situation might happen is given by this function, which happens to be the absolute value of a sine function in a certain simple model. This is considered absolutely absurd. So unless, my claim is it's absurd, unless you can point towards a conservation law of nature. After all, mouse droppings also obey the law of conservation of angular momentum. And all the other conservation laws of nature are even by mice, they are being obeyed. Is there a conservation law that could be obeyed by the mouse and his droppings that could explain this apparent conspiracy? I claim there is, and it's simply the fact that the ontological state of the universe is not in a quantum superposition. Because if Alice and Bob would rotate a device, but the photon would come out as a superposition of the two answers, then you would get this apparent contradiction. However, the photon knows way in advance what the polarization choice of Bob and Alice will be, because according to the model, there will never be a superposition of states. So the photon will never be in that superposition. It will always be in one particular mode, because the fact whether or not the universe is in an ontological state is a conserved property of the model. It's a very complicated property, but it is absolutely conserved. So that conservation law tells you that there's nothing strange going on with this experiment at all. It's not easy to accept this argument. Even, you know, I'm doing my best now. I'm sure there are many people here saying that we don't believe you. Well, so the bottom line would be that I have to make models to show whether this argument is actually correct or not. That there's just a conservation law that tells Bob and Alice what to do. And the conservation law tells you that some configurations are more or less probable than others. So this tells you that certain configurations of the entangled photons and the settings by Bob and Alice are actually correlated. And that correlation would be ridiculous unless it is protected by a conservation law. The idea is that actually the thing we call the vacuum state today is actually a very complicated correlated state of the cellular automaton. It has correlations everywhere in a very, very complicated way. These correlations are being conserved all the time, but never go away, because we were never getting far away from the vacuum state. So this correlation law is a natural consequence of the correlation laws that we always have had from the very beginning onwards in the universe. It was there and doesn't go away. So that is my defense against the attack done by Bell. Actually, I claim that the problem already occurs with single photons. You don't have to consider really entangled photons. You certainly get a big problem with entangled photons, but the problem already occurs with single photons, because having a single photon going through the universe for billions of years, and eventually someone sets the polarization filter to measure the polarization of the photon, and half the time the photon is being accepted or the photon is being rejected by the polarization filter, that is a measurement that can become classical. But the photon must have been in an ontological state from the very beginning. So billions of years ago, the photon already knew what the orientation of your filter would be. It sounds very strange unless you say, well, but this is a law of nature. There's nothing to be done about that. That's the way it works. So that you have to get used to. So is this conspiracy? Well, I have this argument, but the bottom line of the argument is always shut up and do a calculation. Work on the models. So I now sat down and said, instead of trying to defend my argument any further about the Bell inequalities, let's try to find better models. And now I come to the other topic about the error of time. Because as I explained in the beginning of my talk, there was one assumption I made about a cellular automaton, which was a cellular automaton is time reversible. If I know how to go forward in time, I calculate backwards in time. Was that really necessary is a question, or maybe perhaps not. There are numerous examples of cellular automata in mathematics. You can read Stephen Wolfram's book about that. It contains numerous examples. Most of those cellular automata are not time reversible. Why should it be time reversible? And here I have a model of nature at the left, a little bit more complicated than the cogwheel model, that says I have two more states labeled 4 and 5, and they evolve as the arrows are indicating here. So state 4 goes to 5, 5 goes to 1, and then once you're in that mode, you'll go circles all the time. Well, you could argue that that would give you an operator which is no longer a pure permutation. It's a matrix which is not a unitary matrix. It's not unitary because, for instance, the fourth row only contains zeros, and that's not unitary. So how do we do this? This would not be quantum mechanics described by Hermitian Hamiltonian. So at first I'd say, I can't do this model. This is not a cellular automaton I can turn to something quantum mechanical. Well, perhaps not, but maybe you can if you introduce a notion of equivalence classes. And I now talk about information equivalence classes, saying that state number 5 is equivalent to state number 3. Why? Well, after a few steps, state number 5 and state number 3 will always be indistinguishable from each other. They all evolve into exactly the same state in the distant future. Similarly, state number 4 will be information equivalent to state number 2, because after a while, they evolve into the same state. So let's rephrase the way in which I map this model to a quantum model by talking about equivalence classes. So state number 3 and 5 are equivalent, state number 2 and 4 are equivalent. The three equivalent classes just run around like that, and that is a unitary operation. So now I restore unitarity, and I can rephrase quantum mechanics. But the quantum state is no longer an individual ontological state, but it is an equivalence class. And now I can proceed and do the same thing. So consider again this model with these 31 states that you had before, but now add more to it. All these are elements, situations which don't survive very long. After a while, you go into one of these things which are just the equivalence class, which are these. And once you're there, you stay there forever. So this is an extended model. Perhaps our universe is more like a model like this. The spectrum of states will be the same as what I had before, but now in terms of the equivalence classes, the one difference is the equivalence classes are not exactly ontological. They are quantum states now. Those I can turn backwards in time, But the ontological states cannot be turned back in time because you don't know where to go. If you have one of these splitting points, you don't know in which path you have to go. The green points, by the way, are so-called gardens of Eden in computer language. Once you are there, you can move away from the point, but you can never get there. So that's called the Garden of Eden. And so this theory can be time-reversed, but only in terms of the equivalence classes. The equivalence classes correspond to quantum states. You can write them as an orthogonal matrix and so on, and you can turn them back in time, but not the ontological states. And this gives something very remarkable. The quantum theory is completely time reversible, but the classical theory is not. And that means that that indeed this tells you something about the error of time. Because now the classical modes that we look at are not time reversible, not at all. In fact, the suspicion is that there's a theory about black holes, that the total number of quantum states of a black hole is only proportional to the surface area of a black hole, whereas the total number of ontological states are much more likely to be enumerable as the volume of the black hole. The volume is much, much bigger than its surface. So the total number of states that you see here in the real universe must be much, much bigger than this number of states. If that's the situation, then these quantum states are much less identifiable as ontological states, whereas these states are. And these are not time reversible. So the classical states are therefore not time reversible. And of course, when you look at classical states, you immediately see they're not time reversible. We are not time reversible. You can't transform us backwards in time as easily as forwards in time. So obviously, quantum states have an error of time, or classical states have an error of time in them. But the underlying quantum states, the quantum templates, seem to be PCT invariant. And that's only because we are using quantum mechanics as a tool that we get PCT invariance at the level of elementary particles, whereas the classical states and the ontological states, they are not PCT invariant at all. This could be a rather unconventional answer to the question of the error of time. I want to do some classical calculations, but my time is really running out, I think. I don't know how much time I have left. Okay, then I'll go a little bit into some calculations, because the whole subject lives by doing model calculations. And there's one very interesting model I want to ask your attention to. It's a very simple model, but a quantum field theory this time. The quantum field theory describes massless neutrinos, not yet with interaction. So I have massless non-interacting neutrinos. They are described in a two-component neutrino theory in terms of the Pauli matrices, not the Dirac matrices, because it's just two components and they're electrically neutral. So then you have the very simple Pauli version of the Dirac equation, and the Hamiltonian is just sigma dot p. There's no mass term because they are massless. In that model for a single neutrino, I can identify my beables. I can identify operators which commute at all times. And they are listed here. I doubt whether you can follow the calculation so quickly. It's not an easy calculation. But you can write down the orientation of momentum vector. That's p hat here. The orientation of momentum vector is one beable. The spin in the direction of momentum is another beable. It is just plus or minus one. And then the position in the direction of p hat is a third beable. I claim all these commute. For the first two, it's easy to prove that the fact that this one also commutes with the other is slightly less trivial to see. But you can see that this is related to the dilatation operator, whereas the orientation momentum with the length removed is dilatation invariant. So that's why this operator commutes with that one, therefore also with this one. They all commute. And the time evolution operators are very simple. The R operator increases if S is plus one and decreases if S is minus one. And that's all there is about the evolution mode. It's really very simple. I should have DDT S. I see the S has disappeared. The S DT is zero and the R DT is S. So that actually represents a sheet. So the massless neutrino in an ontological theory describes massless sheets going with the speed of light. The sheet is a sheet because the arc orders, it describes the distance of the sheet from the horizon, but doesn't tell you the transverse direction. And the S variable tells you whether the sheet goes to the right or goes to the left, in both cases with the speed of light. This is a completely ontological theory. This could be regarded as a cellular automaton. It's not quite local because the sheet, of course, is defined non-locally, but the equations of motion of the system is completely local. The equation of motion says that locally, you know exactly how the sheet evolves to the right or to the left. However, there's one fundamental problem with this Hamiltonian. It's not bounded from below. This has no vacuum state. So off we go with a model, no good model. Wait a minute. Paul Dirac told us what to do in such a case. You second quantize the theory. By the way, one can invert the operation. Once you know a sheet, I can reproduce from the sheet the Dirac operators X and P and sigma. That is not an easy calculation. And before, I did a calculation, but there's some blood on this because of all the errors I made before I got the right answer. It's not easy to get the right answer. You have the inverse of the momentum in the R direction. That's an integral operator. But so this relation is a complicated relation, but it holds and tells you that there's a one-to-one mapping between the quantum neutrinos and this classical theory of sheets. But Dirac told us what to do, and he said you have to second quantize. First quantization, just a model with 31 states here. Consider again this example. Second quantization occurs when you put dots in them. There's either a dot or no dot in all these boxes, and these dots evolve the same way as the original model does, but now I don't have 31 states, but I have 2^31 states. Now the Hamiltonian, in the original model, the Hamiltonian is not bounded from below. The consequence of that is that the Hamiltonian is this thing. If I terminate the Campbell-Baker-Hausdorff series at some point, I get that the ground state is where the arrow is, but that's exactly where I make a calculational error. My line is not infinitely sharp, but is rounded off. And that means that the biggest error of the calculation is exactly where I want to do the calculation, which is near the vacuum state. Now, if you second quantize, you get something much better. You get the Hamiltonian, which is centered around the origin there. And there, it's easy after a few iterations to get a very accurate expression for the Hamiltonian of the system. And now you second quantize. You don't write that the operator, the matrix Hij is not the Hamiltonian itself, but Hij is sandwiched between these fields psi bar and psi. The psi are fermionic fields. This is an elementary computation you can do, and all this works beautifully. This is a Hamiltonian which is local for the neutrinos, as far as neutrinos can be local, and is bounded from below. So this seems to be an interesting model that can serve as a starting point for a quantum field theory that is described by a cellular automaton. Unfortunately, this only works for massless non-interacting neutrinos. I'm still waiting to discover how to do the same thing for other interacting quantum fields so as to reproduce a standard model. That hasn't been successful yet. But the idea is that this is the line to go. You take the same things you did in quantum field theory. You took fields. Later, you have to introduce interactions. But first, you second quantize the fields. And then you say when two fields coincide, some extra things happen that you could call interaction. And then you do your perturbation expansion in the interaction variable. Then you get perturbative quantum field theory. And the strategy is that this way we should be able to reproduce something that looks like a standard model. The perturbative quantum field theory will be a perturbation expansion, which again diverges. But we are used to that in quantum field theory. We're also used to ignore it. The quantum field theory doesn't converge. But if the coupling constant is small, it is good enough for us. And we don't care about it being non-convergent. There will be some lambda ghosts at very high energies that nobody's ever seen, so don't worry about it. The quantum field theory reproduces quantum mechanics exactly as we know it, and that's what counts. So even if the expansion doesn't converge, this will be a very good strategy. But we haven't been able to implement it because I couldn't go further than massless neutrinos, for starters, and we need to have more complicated interacting fields. So, before doing this, I realized that actually there's another complication, gravity. We haven't talked about gravity much yet, but naturally, You have to add the gravitational force, whether you like it or not. There is gravity in the universe. Gravity will change everything. Gravity puts line, time in a very different perspective than we're used to, and it will force us to consider diffeomorphism invariance in nature. That's extremely complicated. We don't know how to quantize gravity. So I don't even know how to write down my quantum model, which I want to replace by a deterministic system. But the reason why I did this investigation is the other way around. I want to find a solution how to quantize gravity. So maybe by starting with these cellular automaton ideas, maybe we get a new entry into also including the gravitational force. Lots of ideas are there, but of course they have not been solved. Otherwise, I would have given a different talk. Diffeomorphism invariance, and I forgot to mention that in when I talked about gauge equivalence classes, about information in gauge equivalence classes, we have gauge theories in the standard model, and we have gauge equivalence classes. Is there a relation between the gauge equivalence classes and the diffeomorphism and the information equivalence classes? I claim, yes, that could very well be the case. That would also include diffeomorphisms. Maybe the fact that we can use different coordinates to describe the world is an information about the world that gets lost, that sinks into a drain of information. And that would be a marvelous way to describe, say, black holes in this formalism, although there's still many mysteries around. So I use this in a hopefully not too well readable text because this is a very uncertain speculation about diffeomorphisms having something to do with the information equivalence classes. If you look at black holes, that may well be the case, but exactly how all this works is still quite mysterious. So there are many questions left over. I have written this down a year ago already on the net, but a new version is in the making, and a new version will contain a lot more and a lot more explanations. In the meantime, this is the situation I'm in now, and I'm ready to take any critical questions and remarks. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for a beautiful talk. I'm sure there are some questions.
Gerard, I wanted to ask you about the few things you said about time irreversibility. It's about time irreversibility. If you have a finite state discrete dynamical system, then it's generally irreversible, but it has a limit set which is consisting of limit cycles which are reversible in your sense. So the generic case of a discrete finite state dynamical system, it makes the extension from a reversible system to an irreversible system exactly as you were talking about automatically. So is that so? In some sense, you're going to the general case, and you naturally get irreversibility.
Well, there are many things I had no time to explain, but of course, the universe as such is so tremendously big. The limit cycles are only academically of importance, but in practice, we are very, very far away from any limit cycle in the universe. So we don't know yet in which of the cycles we are. So information equivalence classes come about when two different automaton configurations merge to become indistinguishable after a while. And we have to decide what to do when there's such a merging of two different states taking place, which become the identical states. So going forward in time is easy, going backwards in time, you hit such a fork, you don't know which of the branch to take. In principle, you take the branch that forms a closed limit cycle to the universe, but we don't know what the limit cycles are. They last much, much longer than the lifetime of the known universe. So we have no patience to figure out which of the branch points we should take.
It seems to me what you have an opportunity, because you could say, look, the generic theory of this kind is irreversible, but when it goes to its limit cycle, and all of them generically go to limit cycles, you discover a reversible theory.
Yes.
So you have a natural mechanism for a fundamentally irreversible dynamics to have an emergent reversible dynamics.
Except that we do not know how to link a limit cycle to an ontological state. So we don't know, we are unable to identify the limit cycles of the universe. The universe isn't anywhere close to any cycle at all. So only parts of the models will be approximately show limit cycles that we could study. But in general, we will get something that looks much more like gauge equivalence classes. And in the gauge theory, you don't know which gauge to choose that is physical. So now I claim, in any gauge theory, there is a gauge that you can choose that makes the theory ontological. But we don't know which gauge that is. And all the others seem to be equally relevant physically. We do not know how to distinguish different gauges in the gauge theory. So it's something similar to that. And I think gauge theories are nice examples of systems where the physical states are not so easy to link even to ordinary quantum fields. Because if you say, take quantum dynamics and only look at the gauge invariant states, it's very complicated. So in practice, these classes are very complex in terms of the physical observables. So I suspect that the information equivalence classes are something similar. They are difficult to identify. And that is what makes this whole thing non-trivial. Otherwise, if it was just incidentally that it would be a fork, and you can ignore them because you can choose any one of them, that's it. But no, it could be that these forks are everywhere, and they make life hellishly more complicated if you want to identify the ontological states. So that then generates more structure in theory that wasn't there before I introduced time non-reversibility.
Yeah, just a quick question. Is there something in the dynamics of the ontic states that guarantees that classical states get mapped to classical states, the classical states stay classical dynamically?
It is basically input. This is the easy part of the theory. You assume some cellular automaton which doesn't know about quantum mechanics. It is just like a cogwheel, literally. And the cogwheel just goes like your clock, or in fact like your laptop. It only turns ontological states into ontological states, and that is it. So, of course, you could think, let's try to make a non-classical automaton. Let's put qubits in an automaton. You can always do that. Then you're back to where you were with quantum mechanics. And then you're also back at your problem with the collapse of the wave function, all these questions. But just by insisting that ontological states evolve to ontological states, you get some of the group features of the theory, such as the collapse of the wave function, all that comes out automatically.
Well, I was thinking more about your map. You had the two images, one with the templates in the middle, and then you took the templates out, and on the right-hand side, you had S1, S2, or associated with a single classical state. And what I was wondering about is it S1, or is it, it's around slide 15 or something like that.
Is it this?
No, it's well before that. Yeah,
this one.
That, yes, this, okay, they're not S, submicrostate. So if you call those S1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, whatever, if you end, I'm wondering what happens if you end up in S1 and S3, so S1 and S3 are associated in the map on the right.
I don't quite understand your question. The claim is that picture says exactly a very important message, that the classical states are linked each to different ontological states, and there's no crosstalk. There's no superposition of ontological states in these macroscopic states.
Oh, I see. They're not a combination. They're equivalent classes.
So, when they are equivalence classes, it would be the same thing. So every single macroscopic state, if these are equivalence classes, basically the same pictures would hold. But these would be equivalence classes. These could be, I would have a line before this. I would have all possible submicrostates, then make them into equivalence classes, then I get these states. and then the rest of the picture will be the same. So indeed, it's good to ask the question that if you have information loss, then it would be one line before this, containing all these all these equivalent states distinguished. But the claim is that is unobservable, because if you wait long enough, all the elements of the equivalence class will merge to the same state, and you can no longer distinguish them. And the information is lost forever. So no registration. As soon as anything would have registered, then that would not be equivalent. So the registration completely disappears. So from that moment on, you have just this picture.
Okay, thank you.
So I was wondering about the energy spectra that you're producing with the cellular automata. These things look a lot like random matrices, like, you know, the eigenvalues of random matrices, but there is some underlying structure because of where you're getting them from.
Yes.
I was wondering if you can, you know, reproduce like the predictions of random matrix theory. Like, could you point to, say, a class of cellular automata that would give you the Gaussian unitary ensemble or something like that?
Well, if you look at these very simple toy models, I think the answer is no, that this is still much too limited, right? What I have here might look complicated at the right. Actually, the right spectrum is just literally the middle spectrum squeezed together, and that contains lots of structure that random matrices, of course, do not have.
Right, but even if you go to like the large, you know, the more much more complicated limit, then you've always got this underlying structure, and the whole thing about random matrices is they've kind of
But in the real world, the Hamiltonian, of course, is practically continuous, because we've
right.
such a large universe that so many states, most particles have a continuous spectrum rather than discrete. And for a continuous spectrum, of course, this at first sight looks very trivial, very easy to do, because you have always enough lines to your disposal to make a continuous lab spectrum. In reality, of course, you have to combine this with the locality demand. I want my Hamiltonian to describe local physics, and I want local physics to be local in terms of the automaton. There are all sorts of questions of mathematical nature which I'm not sure I can answer, and maybe there are different options available. So you don't have to buy everything I said. Maybe you'll say, well, I want a local Hamiltonian, locality will force me to do other things besides this. That could well be the case.
So this issue of conservation laws that you mentioned is very interesting, because I guess usually people interpret this resolution of Bell inequality or Bell problem in for classical hidden variable theory, they said that it should be instantaneous communication between different Alice and Bob. Right? So if you want to have a classical hidden variable theory, you need instantaneous communication. And you're saying that it's the conservation law of nature instead of instantaneous.
Yeah, so, yes, indeed. So I'm not sure I can find it here. It's here. So. Indeed, this is today the only escape route I can imagine. So if you don't like it, I have nothing.
I do quite like it, but I just want to say there is, in fact, this kind of ambiguity when people talk about instantaneous communication. In fact, what happens if you take a hyperbolic equation and let a speed of propagation go to infinity, then you end up with an elliptic equation, which is basically like Gauss's law. And you can think of it as it's not quite a conservation law, it's a local constraint equation. But
are you talking about a causal theories or?
Well, I'm saying that it's basically whether instantaneous communication is indistinguishable from conservation laws, or basically a series of conservation laws. Because you can think of a constraint equation like Einstein constraint equations or electromagnetism constraint equations as a large number of conservation laws. At each, basically, you have elliptic equation, which you can take the moments of it, for example, and say, so you have all these infinite number of conserved quantities. So I'm saying that these two might be actually, so your way of thinking about it might be better than the way that people are talking about it. So instantaneous communication is really the same thing as constraint equations, basically.
Well, when you talk about conservation laws, it doesn't look so mysterious anymore.
That's right.
There's no A causality, there's no instant communication between Alice and Bob, or Alice and Bob and that atom emitting the two entangled photons. No instantaneous communication, just correlations. And correlations are quite natural in nature everywhere, which doesn't mean that there are signals going faster than light. It just means that it's having a common origin, as someone here already argued also in the talk. You have to distinguish non-local correlation functions, which are quite acceptable, from non-local dynamics, which is much more difficult to accept.
But, so
I personally do not accept non-local dynamics principle, but I do accept non-local correlations. And so this function here is a typical example of a non-local correlation that you might be puzzled about, right, but which could be a consequence of a conservation law. The correlation functions are conserved in time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. So I wonder if you have any comments on entropy. When we think of the vacuum state, normally we think of it as having zero entropy. And yet in this model, in a certain sense, it's a very complicated. Of course, it's really only a single state, but we don't know which. So by the usual classical rules, we might attribute a large entropy. Is there a conflict in more generally, what in a thermal system or whatever, do you have any comment on what's the relation between entropy computed in the quantum way and entropy as we would have naively done it classically, thinking of it as just a large ensemble of classical states?
Well, the theory I'm advocating here is a theory about microphysics. So right, entropy is slightly less essential when you consider single atoms or single particles. You usually don't worry about entropy. But in the real world, of course, entropy plays a very important role, and in particular in connection with black holes. And there your question is a very important one, because in the case of black holes, an observer who goes into a black hole may freely cross the horizon and say there's no information in that horizon, there's no information in the vacuum there, I'm just in the vacuum and that's it. So one bit of information describes everything for the ingoing observer. Whereas an outgoing observer sees Hawking particles and then says that there are thousands of bits of information in these particles. The entropy is very high, presumably. So that makes a black hole a thermodynamically interesting object with very high entropy, in spite of the fact that an ingoing observer sees no entropy at all. So the whole notion of entropy here becomes very important. And it's one of the questions which I wanted to answer very badly. As I mentioned in the beginning of my talk, I wanted to ask questions about black hole information, about quantum gravity and all this sort of stuff. Instead, I end up answering different questions, but which to me is an indication I might be on the right track. But it still means I haven't answered the question I really wanted to answer, which was indeed of the kind that you ask. What is it, does entropy really mean? What does entanglement entropy mean for a black hole? And so on and so forth. There are also the questions people ask about firewalls, and we're having big discussions about those. I wanted to answer such questions, instead end up answering this. So the theory being a theory about what happens microscopically is evading the entropy question. In the very end, however, I think the entropy is very important. This property, for instance, must also be a property of the vacuum states. The vacuum is full of fluctuations, which are correlated. Right. And we all know that the vacuum eventually is described as a single template state. So I call a vacuum indeed a template. It's ontologically probably a combination of billions and billions of different possible ontological states, which together form one vacuum state with one particular choice of the superposition coefficients. So what entropy to assign to the vacuum? Well, that depends on the basis that you use and so on, and whether you are considering entanglement entropy of a vacuum here and a vacuum there, and having a sharp Rindler-like horizon separating the two. If you do that, then you get a different definition of entropy for the vacuum than what you normally would do for a vacuum state, saying it has no entropy whatsoever. Entropy is zero for the vacuum. So I don't know whether this is anything.
Well, partly, yeah. I mean, we do have a classical model of how to think about entropy.
which was the Boltzmann model of counting the number of microstates. This could all be done at the classical level. So I'm just wondering whether whether you think that's
very similar to my ideas about entropy are very similar to what other people think about entropy. That it has to do with information, but difficulty, which has also been signaled here by several people, that the difficulty is what exactly is information, and that complicates the issue of the question what is entropy. Entropy is very roughly speaking the logarithm of the amount of information that you have, but there's more to it than that, and the amount of information about the vacuum depends on how you look at the vacuum. Yes, so I think there are problems there which also relate to Eric van Linden's talk the other day,
right?
About entropy being a relevant notion to understand the gravitational force. Maybe all these things are coming together, but I don't have all my answers ready yet.
Okay, thank you.
It seems an important, if I understand properly, an important technical part of your construction is the ability to take somehow the log of the automaton evolution matrix to extract an Hamiltonian.
I don't understand you, sorry.
I'm saying an important technical piece of your construction, yes, seems is to map quantum mechanics onto automaton, is to be able to take the log of the logarithm of the automaton evolution matrix, which creates an Hamiltonian which is modularized, or modular in the sense of R and of modular variable. So that is, you know, periodic. And presumably something similar happens to time. That is, time is either modularized or discretized. And I was wondering, you did not comment it too much on the fact that this seems to be a specific feature of your representation, the modularization of energy and the modularization of time, which, you know, I want you to comment a little bit more on that, because it seems a very, you know, dramatic or drastic prediction. And how does that, how do you think the notion of causality in this modular version of H and T?
Right. At the level of this theory, I'm a little bit vague in to define exactly what time is, just because I want to leave the different options open. For instance, in general relativity, you think of time very differently than in quantum field theory. And exactly how to think of time, the most natural thing in a general theory, it would be that you look at Cauchy surfaces. And the question then is, do I need a continuum of Cauchy surfaces, or can I discretize the Cauchy surfaces? I leave these various options open for the moment, because it doesn't matter too much for the general picture here. How dense are the time steps that you make? I imagine time to be discrete, because that is mathematically by far the easiest situation to consider. But it also means that in between two discrete time steps, the situation is not well defined. So I can take a Hamiltonian, which can take any values you like if you evolve a system to go to between two time steps. But it must give the cellular automaton when you are on a time step. So that gives you freedom in defining the Hamiltonian. And my idea is to use that freedom as much as we can to get decent-looking Hamiltonians. For instance, locality. The classical model is local. The quantum theory that we want to explain, like the standard model, obeys locality in the quantum mechanical sense. That's to say that commutators vanish outside the light cone. What I want is construct a Hamiltonian. And because my model is classically local, I want that Hamiltonian also to generate states where the commutators vanish outside the light cone. That's a very tough demand, it turns out, technically. So that's why I wanted to use second quantization of quantum field theories, which I constructed in the same spirit as I did with the neutrinos, but then tried to do it for the other particles as well, and apply second quantization so that you have second quantized fields, and then allow those fields to interact very weakly so that you get the weakly interacting quantum field theory. That will be the standard model. So that will be the strategy, but it's a long way to go. Right. Yes, so my Hamiltonian, if you have a fixed discrete time step, the Hamiltonian becomes an a periodic operator, right? After Hamiltonian is 2 pi over delta t, you're back to zero again. And the problem with that, of course, is that now you don't know which of these states is the vacuum state. Where should I cut off my Hamiltonian? And this at first sight looks like an arbitrary procedure. That doesn't sound right because it looks as if the vacuum state is a very precisely defined state in nature. So what makes the vacuum so different from all the other states? Well, we can guess what the answer to that is. It's Lorentz invariance. The vacuum is the only Lorentz invariant state. And it allows particles to be created but not to be annihilated. We are searching for a model which allows for such a special state to occur. Whereas in cellular automaton, we have a situation that, as you already described, Hamiltonian is periodic. So there is no good candidate for the vacuum state. And so that means that a cellular automaton just by itself is probably not good enough. I have to do something more, such as what I propose, second compensation. But then what I also have to do is include the gravitational force. And the ordinary cellular automaton is difficult to reconcile with the curved space-time, particularly when the curvature is dynamical. So I could imagine a cellular automaton which sits on a lattice that has a lattice defects to accommodate for curvature. And those defects themselves also obey a certain evolution law. We probably have to go in that direction and then combine that with the question whether time is discrete or continuous. There are various options. We can also imagine that time is discrete for a small region of the universe. But if you combine small regions to make a very large region of the universe, you put those times in between. So in the limit that the universe becomes infinitely big, time again is a continuous variable. You could think of such a construction because you want energies to diverge for large universes, but not for small universes. A small universe has a limited amount of energy because if energy is too big, you get a black hole which doesn't fit in there. So there's a natural ceiling to the Hamiltonian for very small sections of the universe, but not for very large sections of the universe. So probably you have to intertwine the time steps some way or other. If I knew exactly how to do that, I would have told you, but I don't. I can only give a very general picture of what one might possibly expect to happen.
Yes. Thank you for your talk. You addressed Bell's theorem, which is one of at least two important theorems that constrain hidden variable models that would agree with the predictions of quantum mechanics. And the second one I have in mind is the Cochen-Specker theorem. I'm wondering, I'd like to hear your thoughts on that and whether your model peacefully coexists with that, either via adopting contextuality or do we get out via this superdeterminism conspiracy theory?
Right. I consider all these variations on the Bell theme, such as the theorem. It is very reminiscent of Bell. It addresses the same issues, but the bottom line always is that you allow observers to measure operators you do not commute. Or rather, both Bob and Alice have the option between various non-commuting operators to measure them. They can't measure both at the same time. And that is what all these theorems all have in common. And that's where all the apparent contradictions come from. And so I have the same answer to all of these, if you accept the answer, which is, well, I still have to accept it myself also. So if, I don't blame you if you don't. But my answer is that there should be a ontology conservation law which should answer that in principle. But that answer should hold for all the versions of the Bell theorem. You're right, there are quite a few different theorems of the same nature, which has the same ground idea that an observer can choose which operator to measure. That's always the bottom line. And that's the same in all these different versions of Bell's theorem. And there, one has to answer that question. And superdeterminism is one part of the argument. The absence of free will is related to that. But eventually, I think the ontology conservation law is perhaps a better way of phrasing things, that nature has its conservation law ready to explain to you why these strange correlations persist where you wouldn't have expected them.
Okay, one very last question.
Yeah, so I like this way of thinking about quantum mechanics, but I do also have a question about the vacuum in particular. I mean, that's an eigenstate which clearly is not one of your sort of classical states. But what makes it so special? Because we can still imagine doing measurements, or as you actually argued, we can distinguish the vacuum classically from being not the vacuum. So why isn't this one of your ontological states? And this seems even true for other energy eigenstates. The Hamiltonian is clearly not an operator that we seem to be able to measure classically in your model. Well, we know we are doing this quite often, and so the vacuum is one of those states that I think is hard to distinguish.
You ask two very important questions. The vacuum is indeed an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, and that Hamiltonian, by definition, is not abelable. Therefore, its eigenstates are not. So the vacuum, in that sense, is not abelable. However, at the same time, you say, well, a planet moving in the vacuum, we can distinguish that vacuum from where the planet is. So I suspect the answer to the question will be that microscopically, we cannot distinguish the vacuum from excited states. Think of the Casimir effect, but think of, quite generally, if you select out a tiny little piece of the universe, and you ask, is that vacuum or not? You can't answer it. But you can answer it if you look at the vacuum as a very large region of space-time. So I think the correct answer to your question is that if you take a sufficiently large region of the universe, and then you can answer the question, is that a vacuum or not? And that you can do statistically. Locally, you don't know how to distinguish the vacuum from excited states. But globally, you can, because you have so much more statistical information to your disposal. And if you look at all the correlations, all the vacuum fluctuations that you see in this vacuum state, you can say, now I have a large region of space-time. Now I can distinguish that from the state where there's a planet moving in that vacuum, or a molecule or anything that is sufficiently classical to distinguish it from the classical state, from the vacuum state. Of course, single atoms or single subatomic particles could be part of a vacuum fluctuation. So when you isolate a sufficiently small region of vacuum, you can't distinguish that from the vacuum state. In a large regional vacuum, you can. So you use statistics to do that. Same as people use statistics also in humanities. When you have a sample of sufficient large number of people, you can figure out whether a disease occurs there or not. If you look at just one person, you never know for sure whether that's an epidemic disease or not. But for large samples, you can. So take a sufficient large sample, and you can distinguish ontologically the vacuum from the other states.
Okay. So let's thank Gerard again. Thank you.